Choices. You have to perform activities C, D and E. Your work will be too fragmented if you work on all three at the same time, so you choose to work on activity D first, then E and then C, perhaps getting the most difficult one out of the way first. Logical dependencies. Performing certain activities before others sometimes seems to make the most sense. Because so much of chapters 1 and 2 in your report depend on what you write in chapter 3, you decide to write chapter 3 first. External dependencies. Starting a project activity may require that an activity outside the project be completed. For example, you can't start a particular test activity until your organization's test laboratory receives and installs a new piece of test equipment that's currently on order. Discriminate very clearly between activity dependencies that are mandatory and those that you've chosen, and note the details in your plan. Where you've chosen to do things in a particular sequence, you can alter it later if you change your mind. You can't change your mind about the legal constraints affecting activity sequence, though. They're fixed, and you must live with them. Notes in the plan also help other people to understand why you've set up the dependencies in a particular way. With the network you build up through the guidance of the previous sections, it's still early days with the activity planning, but the network already reveals useful information. Even before you finish the network, you can see whether you can meet any required end date. You can also get useful preliminary information from the critical path. A lot of risks come to light during planning. Note them down and start thinking about them now. Something else you may notice from the network, if you already know who will be doing what, is a resource constraint. If you happen to know that the person who's making the adjustments to the computer system is the same person who'll be producing the test data, then although these two activities aren't dependent on each other logically, a resource dependency exists because one person can't do two full-time jobs simultaneously. You may be starting to think that this planning stuff is really interesting, but it's also getting rather detailed. The answer to both issues is, yes, it is, isn't it? The detail is important, however, because it recognizes the reality of the project. Taking the example of the resource conflict for the person adjusting the computer system, it's just not possible to do two full-time jobs on the project simultaneously. The resource issue is a genuine project planning problem that needs to be resolved. It's not merely a matter of fine detail that's over the top and not really necessary. If your network shows you can't meet a required date, don't panic. With the product and activity plans, you have powerful tools you can work with to adjust the project so that it will fit, and with time to spare for contingency. You can't finalize the plan when you've done the activity network because there is still the whole area of resource planning to consider. You do get early warning of a timing problem, though, if your activity network shows that you will miss the end date. There will be things that you can do, and not least to identify activities that could be shortened or crashed by adding extra resource, usually, but not always, extra staff. If you do find activities that can be crashed, you can try to get some extra resource from your project and take that into account when starting the resource planning. You may well be looking to reduce the duration of a number of activities, but clearly your primary focus will be the critical path. Being the longest path and the one that determines the length of the project, that's the set of activities that you must ultimately reduce in duration. That may even mean leaving some out and so reducing the scope of the project to fit the time available. When working with a schedule, it can be tempting to try and make the activities fit the time available instead of calculating the time needed to do those activities. Don't do it. If you reduce the estimates to fit, you simply end up with an unrealistic plan and a late or even failed project. The estimate isn't how long you want the activity to take or how long someone tells you it must take. The estimate is how long you think it really will take. Because estimating is quite difficult to get right, and because if the estimates are significantly out, it undermines the plan, let's focus on some issues to bear in mind and outline some techniques that may help. Unrealistically short duration estimates can lead to an interesting array of serious project problems. The work simply can't be done in the time set down on the plan, so the project goes wildly off track and becomes very hard to control. The plan is hopelessly unrealistic and so virtually useless as a management tool. Because unrealistic estimates appear to meet your schedule's targets, you don't seek realistic alternative strategies that increase the chances of accomplishing activities in required durations. Because the work actually takes longer than the plan allows, delivery will be late. Delivery of the end product, but perhaps also products that are being taken into operational use during the project. That causes disruption to the business, including dependent projects that expected things to be in place at a certain time. If people believe duration estimates are totally unrealistic, they stop trying to achieve them. When delays occur during an activity, people accept them as inevitable instead of seeking ways to overcome them. Quality goes out of the window as team members race to throw things together to get somewhere near to the deadlines. The planned tests and checks become a joke. However, those on the receiving end of the deliverables don't share the humor when things don't work properly and cause operational problems. When your project fails to meet the end date or quality has suffered badly, both the project and you are perceived as failures. In a small project, where you're familiar with the work, you can probably come up with the estimates yourself. However, after the project moves beyond small and starts to involve more skill sets and people, you almost certainly need to consult others. Where you don't know the project area at all, you'll need a lot of input from other people. When estimating an activity's duration, consider past experience, including any records of previous projects you can get your hands on, expert opinion, and other available sources of information. The more important your project and the more significant the deadline, the more you need to do to clarify the different components of the activity when estimating physical processes, fixed durations for things such as concrete curing and paint drying, time delays, such as waiting for supply after ordering, work needing physical resources, activities that computers and other machines perform, such as running a trial batch on the production line that goes at a set speed, work performed by people, physical and mental activities that people perform, such as writing a report, assembling a piece of equipment, and thinking of ideas for an ad campaign. When you look for information and advice to help with estimating, think about asking experts who are familiar with the work, records from similar tasks in past projects, and staff who will be doing the work and who will have an understanding of it. You can also use estimating techniques. Had you been an ancient Greek, you might have sought guidance from the oracle at Delphi. How the oracle actually worked is lost in the mists of time, but one theory is that it was a group of wise people who consulted between themselves and then gave a single answer. Similarly, you can ask people for estimates using the Delphi technique. As to whether they're wise or not, the Delphi technique works well in a workshop. You explain an activity and then get everyone to write down how long they think it will take to carry out the activity. You then gather up the individual estimates, calculate the average, and use that as the estimate in the plan. Modified Delphi is where you take the estimating a step further. Having got everyone's opinion, you identify the person who gave the most optimistic estimate and the person with the most pessimistic estimate, and you ask them to explain their thinking. Everyone listens carefully, then they estimate again. You take the average and put it in your plan. Three-point estimating establishes the best case, worst case, and most likely case. Although you will almost certainly use the most likely value for the plan, it may help to note the best and worst cases so other people can see the range and not get too worried if the work goes a bit beyond the estimate in either direction during the project. You won't find an easy way of getting estimates right, but you can do three things about the inherent uncertainty. Allow additional contingency. The more uncertain you are about the estimates, the more time you need to allow for things taking longer than anticipated. Warn people. Note in the plan that the estimates may be incorrect. You can state your confidence in the estimates, such as that in one part of the project, you're 90% confident that the estimates are close. Update the estimates and the plan. When better information comes to hand as the project continues, feed that new information into the plan. Chapter 7. Looking at Resources. You can't accomplish anything with nothing, and in the context of project resource planning, you need people, money, and often equipment and facilities. Many project managers tend to underestimate this resourcing. Don't be daunted by it, but instead allow time to think it through and plan thoroughly. That means getting the best out of your staff, almost certainly the most important factor, but also equipment and funding. By the way, using project staff well isn't selfish either. Good project management includes giving team members opportunities to succeed and develop alongside you getting a successful project, and that needs careful thought and planning too. Before you roll your sleeves up and get stuck into the detail of how to plan your use of staff and physical, non-staff resource on the project, it's helpful to be clear about why you need to do this planning. The first reason that you need to plan staff resource is that your use of staff can conflict in several ways with something else. Resource conflicts make your plan completely unworkable if you don't deal with them. Here are three examples of resource conflict. 1. Multiple tasks. The plan has a number of activities, including three, which will take a month each. The activity network shows that the three can be done in parallel, and each one involves Sue working full-time. However, unless Sue is Superwoman and can work three shifts a day, of 8 hours each, 24 hours working, for a whole month, we seem to have a problem. 2. Calendar events. A task is 3 days' duration, and Sue is required to work 8 hours a day. On the plan, the task is to be done from the 1st to the 3rd of January. But now there's a problem with the calendar. Because the 1st of January is a public holiday, there are only 2 working days in that period, not 3, so the task can't be achieved. The plan isn't going to work unless this is sorted out, because the offices are shut on the 1st of January and Sue just won't be there. Oh yes, and 4 months ago, she booked annual leave for the 2nd and 3rd of January because it's her husband's 30th birthday, and she's booked a surprise trip to Paris. And although Sue appreciates that the project is quite important... 3. Other projects. For another task, Sue is needed for 5 days for the week commencing the 8th of February. Oh joy, she isn't working on any other project activity during that week, and neither are there any public holidays or birthday surprises. But now, we find that another project also needs her for 5 days in the week commencing the 8th of February. Unfortunately, that other project has a much higher priority than ours. The last of these conflicts reveals the messy but realistic situation that you sometimes find yourself in, sorting out resourcing between projects, not just within your own. You must allow time for planning at the front end of your project, because if you don't sort these problems out on the plan, they'll hit you later on during the project when they'll be even harder to deal with. Picking up the last example again, Sue isn't going to be working on the project on the 8th of February, even if it's on the plan in red letters, bold type, and underlined. If it stays on the plan that she will be there, the plan is unrealistic, and the project will hit a major problem on the 8th of February. Having hopefully convinced you that resource conflicts for both staff and physical resource can cause problems, you may now be wondering how you actually resolve them. Another reason you need to plan staff resource is so you can tell people when you'll need them and arrange, if necessary, for their managers to release them to work on the project. The resource plan makes everything visible, and people who are taking part in the project or who are authorising the staff hours can make sure they can meet the commitment in terms of the number of staff, the particular skills and people involved, and the dates that you actually need them. That word commitment is significant, because you don't want empty promises that cause you problems later if the resource doesn't materialise. The same argument applies to physical resource. In some cases, equipment must be borrowed or hired, so you need to be sure it will be there when you need it. If there's some doubt about that availability, that may raise the question of whether it would be better to buy it rather than hire or borrow it. Some organisations have procedures and even systems that detail and track every resource on every project. Other organisations don't formally plan or track project resources at all. However, even if your organisation doesn't require you to plan your resource needs and track your resource use, doing so is vital to your project success. Even in terms of progress and control, how can you tell whether the project is on track if you don't know whether the actual use of staff hours on work so far is as you expected? Your project success rests on your ability to get the right people to perform your project work. That may be in terms of suitably qualified staff or simply just getting enough people, which isn't always so easy. You begin your project planning by looking at what you need to deliver. Next, you decide what activities you'll need performed to create the deliverables. Your third step is to decide what skills and knowledge people must have to perform the activities. To determine the skills and knowledge that people must have for your project, you can work from the product definitions produced as part of your planning. You now develop that thinking as you consider the staff resource needs in more detail. You determine the skill and knowledge requirements by reviewing what is to be built. But as with planning, don't panic if you aren't sure or simply don't know. Remember that being a project manager doesn't usually mean that you're a technical expert, so go and talk to other people, including any project managers who've run similar projects in the past, possible external supplier companies, staff who've worked on similar projects in the past, subject matter experts, your project office, which may have plans and other documents showing staff resource on similar past projects. For most situations, you need to know two pieces of information about a task to determine the qualifications that a person must have to perform it: the required level of proficiency in the needed skills and knowledge, whether the assignment entails working under someone else's guidance when applying the skills or knowledge, working alone to apply the skills or knowledge, managing others who are applying the skills or knowledge. As you think through the tasks, you'll usually need to consider staff development. You want to progress in your career, and so too do your project staff. You need to bear in mind individual needs for development and organizational needs for increasingly skilled staff, as well as getting the project delivered. As you look through the project tasks, you can look for flexibility so people can work on things to learn new skills and increase competence in existing ones. In this way, you help the organization develop its skills base. You interest and motivate staff who are enjoying what they're doing and are challenged by it. For example, you might allocate someone to something that's new for him, but where the task has got a bit of spare time, or put him alongside someone else who's already experienced. The critical path technique comes in useful here. If a task is on the critical path, by definition there's no spare time on it. You will therefore usually want to assign very competent and experienced people to do the work. Equally, if a task has a lot of float or slack time, it may be more suitable for less experienced staff. If the work takes a bit longer to do it than planned, then there won't be any time impact because of the float time on the activity. Having adjusted the plan to develop inexperienced staff, don't now neglect your more experienced people. More experienced staff like a challenge, and if you only allocate them to the mundane tasks that all happen to be on the critical path, they're going to get bored and demotivated. Try to ensure that experienced staff get some of the more juicy project work, and where you do need them to work on something boring because it's critical or helping to develop a more junior team member, you can at least explain why and hold out the promise of something more substantial later on. If you're now thinking that there's a lot to bear in mind when dealing with staff resource on a project, yes, there is. When drawing up the activity network and Gantt chart, you already made some estimates of how long each activity will take. The estimates may be based on good information, such as where you already know exactly who'll do that task and his level of experience. However, it may have been little more than a guess just to get the basic framework of the plan in place. Now's the time to work on the detail of the estimates and make sure that there are no conflicts. If you're using a computer-based project management tool, it will almost certainly include a calendar facility so you can avoid some of the areas of resource conflict. The software will hold details of public holidays and will usually have an additional calendar for each person working on the project so you can enter their availability information, including booked holidays. Resource scheduling is inherently complicated, so don't get worried if things start to look difficult. Just work through in a methodical way and everything will come right in the end. It's tempting to focus simply on the figures when scheduling staff resource, but other factors can have an impact. Here are a few things to bear in mind as you work through the estimates. Irregular availability. Some staff may suddenly be less available than anticipated, so be aware of what their other duties are. If, for example, some of your technical staff are also involved with support and a major breakdown occurs on the production line, they'll suddenly disappear from your project no matter what their percentage availability is on your plan. If the whole factory has come to a standstill, you can't insist that the staff come back to give their 50% of the week to your project and finish fixing the production line next week. Multiple staff. If two or more people are working on a task and must work together on it, then the duration will depend on the one with the least availability. If part of the work can be done without everyone involved, then that impact is reduced. Project dependencies. Sometimes work can't start until staff are released from other work, such as work on other projects, and if there's a delay in the other project, that will knock on to yours. Speed of working. Some staff members perform faster than others, and some organisations perform faster than others. The team size. If a task involves a lot of people, they tend to work more slowly than if it just involves two or three people. That's not least because of the communication and organisation needs within the team. Working environment. People in some working environments are hassled with noise and interruptions, such as phones ringing. Be realistic in assessing the duration of activities and don't expect the same productivity from staff in a disruptive environment that you would from the same staff in a peaceful environment where they can focus and work with few distractions or interruptions. A good estimate is one that's close to how long a task eventually takes. If the estimates are good, then the project will stick pretty close to the plan and will be a whole lot easier to manage than if it keeps veering wildly off plan. Being assigned to a project full-time doesn't mean a person can perform project work at peak productivity 40 hours per week, 52 weeks per year. During your project, your staff will probably need to read organizational circulars, take holiday, go off sick for a while, and yes, even argue about football occasionally before getting down to the day's work. So don't ever think of staff as 100% available to the project. The reality is that they won't be, and if you schedule them for 5 full days a week, then your plan won't work. Someone working full-time on a project is probably available on average 4 days a week. Don't use overtime when planning. Plan using normal working hours only, then if you come under pressure during the project, you have overtime working as a fallback. If you've already planned in overtime, you've got nowhere left to run. Also, be careful of how you think about overtime. Staff working long hours aren't usually as productive in the overtime hours as they are in the normal ones, because they get tired. But they may not be as productive in the normal hours either. If someone knows he has a really long day ahead, he'll tend to pace himself in the early part of the day. Where you're basing estimates on how long something took on a previous project in another organization, or even in another part of your own organization, you need to factor in productivity. What matters isn't how long it took to do an earlier job there, but how long it will take to do the job here. So you may need to make a few adjustments in three areas. Adjusting for the exact nature of the task, adjusting for your people, adjusting for the working environment. For the physical working environment, think about how you might improve it, including ways of working, and so improve productivity. When running projects involving support staff, Nick Graham set up a hot seat system. One person on the team was designated to take all of the support calls for a week. That person would be interrupted frequently, and although he or she did get some project work done, productivity was low. However, the rest of the team were sheltered and could get on without distraction unless a support problem was particularly severe and more help was needed. In the next week, a different team member was in the hot seat, so the hassle was shared out and everyone could work undisturbed for most of the time. Properly completed timesheets provide the most reliable source of past experience. However, it's with good reason that timesheets are often called lie sheets. Before relying on past metrics, make sure that you fully understand the information, and that includes a careful assessment of the organizational culture, which in turn affects how time is recorded. Bad timesheet practices will mean the data is inaccurate. People aren't allowed to record overtime, so some hours actually spent on an activity may never be known. People need to send in their timesheet several days before the reporting period is over, so they must guess what their allocations for the next few days will be. People fill out their timesheets just before they go home at the end of the week. They're in a hurry to get away and can't remember clearly what they did in the early part of the week, so they take a guess and put that down. People are working on some non-project stuff during the week, but are supposed to be allocated full-time on the project. So they spread out the hours spent on the other work among your project time codes. People copy the work effort estimates from the project plan onto their timesheets each period instead of recording the actual number of hours they spend. If any of these situations exist in your organization, don't use historical data from timesheets for estimates in your plan. The resource conflicts explained earlier usually apply to staff. Sometimes, though, you encounter conflicts on things like accommodation or specialized equipment. Physical resource conflicts must be dealt with as well as staff resource conflicts. To check for resource conflict, you need to look at what each person is scheduled to do in each time period, usually each day. If a person has more to do than there is time available in the day, then there is a resource conflict. That may be because it's a public holiday and there are no working hours that day. Here are some straightforward steps for resource smoothing. 1. Check the activity dependencies and allocations. Continuing the example from the last section, you don't want to solve the problem of Sue being overcommitted if you've put her onto the tasks by mistake and you meant to enter Sam. 2. Adjust within float. This is where the activity network pays dividends. You may see from your network that the latest start date of an activity is considerably further on than the earliest start date, so you can simply slide the activity along within its float to a time when someone has plenty of availability. Again, the activity network will be really useful because it shows the dependencies clearly. 3. Adjust resource. Is there someone else who has the same skill set? If so, and he has more availability at this point, can you assign one or more tasks to him instead? Or alternatively, can you put that person on the task alongside to help? In other words, can you raise the line of available resource? 4. Move tasks downstream. If you've made changes but still have a resource conflict, you need to move things downstream and the project end date will go out. In theory, 3 tasks can be done in parallel, but because of a resource constraint that someone must do all 3, they'll have to do them one after the other, and the impact on the end date is accepted. Where you have staff who aren't full-time on the project, you can sometimes squeeze out a bit more flexibility by talking to them about how they allocate their work. For example, if Sam is available to your project for 50% of his time, that needn't mean he just works mornings. If you have a resource conflict in the early part of the week, you could ask if he could work the first half of the week full-time on your project, then spend the second half of the week on his other assignments. Involving team members in estimating and resource planning pays off when it comes to asking people to be flexible to meet the needs of both the project and any other assignments. With all the resourcing issues, the key to success is good plans. If you have clear plans, you not only see the problems, but you also have excellent tools to hand to help solve them. In addition to staff, your project may require a variety of other important resources. You need to plan for these resources in the same way you plan to meet your staff requirements. As always, when you're planning, you'll often find it helpful to talk to other people, to the point of involving them in a planning workshop. It's really important to think through all the resource requirements for your project and also identify any equipment your organization already has. Don't forget things such as accommodation and communications equipment for your teams. It's very easy to focus solely on specialized equipment needed to build the project products and so miss important needs in other areas of the project. It's dangerous to assume that a resource will always be there when you need it. And the more time-critical your project is, the more careful you need to be. If you think that sounds a bit like risk management, you're right, because it overlaps. Things that can affect physical resource availability include bookings from other projects or for operational work, scheduled maintenance, breakdown and damage, unforeseen needs of a higher priority project. Don't kid yourself that the I booked it first argument will unfailingly hold up in the face of a demand from a top priority, business-critical project that has the backing of the whole board of directors, the chief constable, the secretary of state, or, in the military, someone simply pulling rank. Estimating a project's costs is important for several reasons. It's a vital element of the business case to see whether the project is finally justified. It allows organizational managers to assess whether the project should be run by comparing the costs against the benefits of this project compared with other candidate projects that could be run instead. It allows departmental or organizational finance staff to check that the necessary funds are available to support the project and allocate those funds. Managing project finance is an essential part of project management and one that's very high profile. If you work in an organization of any size, you already appreciate just how important finance is. You also know how impressive it is when a project manager delivers a project on time to the required level of quality and also bang on target with the finances. A project budget is a time-based estimate of all resource costs for your project. It normally gives a total projected spend for each stage, then a total for the whole project. If some of the project's products are to be taken into use during the project, you may also start to see some financial savings during the life of the project. In that case, the budget usually needs to show inbound cash flow as well as outbound. You typically develop a budget at 3 points in the project planning: a rough initial estimate when starting up, a full budget when doing the more detailed project planning, then stage budgets in more detail still, if you need them. The project budget is maintained as the project progresses and as better information, including actual costs, becomes available. Your project's budget normally includes both direct and indirect costs. Direct costs are costs for resources solely used for your project. Direct costs include the following: salaries for team members on your project, specific materials, supplies and equipment for your project, subcontracts that provide support exclusively to your project, travel to perform work on your project. Indirect costs are costs for resources that support more than one project but aren't readily identifiable with or chargeable to any of the projects individually. Indirect costs include things such as general services, such as HR, and shared costs that it would be difficult to allocate to different areas of the business. It's important to discriminate clearly between the direct and indirect costs, not least because your finance director will. Indirect costs will already be in the organizational budget, but at least some of the direct costs will need to be specially funded. Many organizations refer to costs as capital and revenue. Revenue is ongoing year-on-year costs, such as building rental, equipment maintenance, and staffing. Capital costs are one-off purchases such as equipment and contract staff. Some organizations prefer to use contract staff for at least some of the project work simply because it can be accounted for as a capital cost, whereas recruiting more permanent staff would show up as an ongoing running cost. Higher revenue costs make an organization appear less efficient because it's spending more on overheads, whereas the staff spend in capital expenditure is hidden. This may seem like political and budgetary maneuvering, which it is, but be aware of it, because it can affect the staffing and funding of your project. Organizational decision makers would love to have a detailed and accurate budget on hand whenever someone proposes a project, so they can assess its relative benefits to the organization and decide whether they have sufficient funds to support it. Unfortunately, you can't prepare such an estimate until you develop a clear understanding of the work and resources the project will require. Try to resist pressure to state a specific project budget up front, before you've done any real thinking about a project. In some organizations, as soon as someone mentions the word project, some finance managers start pushing for a specific project cost. Unfortunately, the finance people then go away and put that figure in the accounts, and just you try changing it now. It's carved in stone. In reality, decisions about whether to go forward with the early parts of a project and how to undertake them must be made before people can prepare highly accurate budgets. The rough order of magnitude estimate is an initial estimate of costs based on a general sense of the project work in the starting the project stage. You make this estimate without detailed data. Depending on the nature of the project, the final budget may end up being much more or less than this initial estimate. You can prepare a rough order of magnitude estimate by considering the costs of similar projects that have already been done, and applicable cost and productivity information if you have the luxury of such information being available. In the organizing and preparing stage, you develop the full budget by examining the staff allocations in the plan and checking what you need to buy and use during the project. This budget is approved as part of the full project's approval. It usually forms part of the project charter, and now provides a baseline against which you can measure project finances. However, even now the budget is not definitive, as you still don't know all the fine detail of the project. For example, you don't know at the start of the project exactly what equipment you'll need to buy because the design hasn't been done yet. As you work through the delivery stages, you prepare more detailed costings as you build successive stage plans, and you then update the project-level budget with fresh projections. Actuals are the information on time actually used on an activity, or in this case, money actually spent. When doing lower stage-level budgeting and making adjustments, you will have the benefit of feedback on the actual time and cost for work done so far. You'll also develop formal agreements for the use of equipment, facilities, vendors, and other resources, so exact costs will be known. It follows that it's important to keep the budget information up to date. You can't use it for checking the current financial position and making projections for the final spend if it is weeks out of date. When thinking through the format of your budget, consider who will be looking at the different parts of it. Typically, the managers who'll approve the project budget won't want to know how many pencil sharpeners you plan to buy in Stage 23 for the user training. An easy approach for budgets is to set them down in three sections: an overview, the full budget, and then the detailed item listings. The item listing can usually be set down in an appendix. It's unlikely that anyone will study this section from end to end, but some people may want to dip in to see how you arrived at a particular figure. In a presentation, you do well to have the detailed information with you, so if any questions do come up, you can quickly refer to it and be incredibly impressive by coming up with fast, accurate, and confident answers. The point has already been made that the budget must be kept up to date, as must the project plans, in order to be useful as a management tool. With a budget, it's helpful to maintain three figures: the planned spend, the actual spend on items reached by this point, the variance between planned and actual spend. Where the variance is significant, you may need to do some work to investigate why and even refer it to the steering committee. At worst case, the variance may call the viability of the project into question. However, it is better to identify such a problem and deal with it to the point of stopping the project than have the project overspending and out of control. Chapter 8. Planning at different times and levels. A great temptation in project planning is to dive into the fine detail and start counting rivets before you're even sure what the project is really about. That's certainly true of planning, and a danger for most people involved in projects is that they go too deep too quickly in planning. Here are a few reasons why it makes sense to get the helicopter view before going into detail. You may be heading in the wrong direction and be doing all sorts of detailed planning on the wrong stuff. It makes sense to check out the high level before going into detail. Things change, particularly in business projects. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense to do the detailed planning a long way ahead, because you can be sure that things will have changed by the time you get there and a lot of your work will be wasted. Until you've seen the bigger picture clearly, you're not going to get the detail right, because you don't properly understand what you're dealing with. For a start, you won't usually be absolutely clear on the scope of the project until the high-level project plan is agreed. Just about all approaches to project planning and control break the project down into phases or stages. This allows you to concentrate on one part of the project at a time while still seeing the bigger picture. Stages also create powerful control points, because between each stage, everyone can take stock and check that the project is okay before going on to the next stage. People often refer to these control points as stage gates. Stages are also useful for resource control, because they allow managers to drip-feed staff resource and money into the project. Although all the project funds and staff resource are earmarked at the outset, The sponsor or steering committee can specifically authorize the release of that resource one stage at a time, checking on each occasion that the project is still viable and on track. Two basic sorts of stages exist in projects: management stages and technical stages. Technical stages relate to the nature of the project work, so you may have, for example, a design stage and a build stage. In terms of control, though, projects often use management stages. A management stage is simply a block of work that the sponsor or steering committee is happy to finance and authorize in one go. A management stage may include several technical stages. You can think of management stages in exactly the same way as ordinary business management. The sponsor is effectively the boss here, so how much does the boss want to authorize at a time, and how often will she check up on the work being done to make sure everything's okay? Of course, you can't answer the question, because it's one that rests on personal judgment. It depends, among other things, on the management style adopted by the boss. A particular boss may exercise quite a lot of control and be happier doing that. However, if another person with a more laid-back management style had been appointed as boss, she might have supervised the same staff much less and checked up less frequently. The project manager may recommend what she thinks is a suitable number of stages for the project and show where they should come. But with management stages, it's for the sponsor to decide on the level of control she wants to take. Here are a few factors to get you thinking. Before a major investment, if there is a point in the project where a considerable amount of money is to be spent, it makes sense to have a stage gate just before it. Experience of the project manager. Just like in general management, depending on the project manager's experience, the boss may want to check up on things more or less often and authorize different amounts at a time. Finance. Stages are different lengths, but a sponsor may put a cash limit on them. So the project will cost £12 million, but no stage is ever to be more than £2 million. Risk. If the project is high risk, a sponsor will tend to want shorter stages so that stage gate checks are more numerous and less is being authorized at a time. Sensible blocks of work. Sometimes you can almost see the stage boundaries on a plan. The groupings of products and good control points are simply obvious, and it's hard to explain it better than that. Time. In the same way as for money, the sponsor may put a limit on the maximum length of a stage. In a 2-year project, the maximum stage length could be, say, 4 months. If there is a block of work that will take 6 months, then it will need to be broken into 2 stages with a stage gate part way through that work. In exactly the same project, a different choice of people on a steering committee or a different choice of sponsor may result in very different decisions on the number of stages in the project. The sponsor or steering committee holds the stage gate at the end of each stage. The stage gate is a look back, a look at where you are now, and then a look forward. Looking back. You look back to check how things went on the stage just finishing. Are there any warning signs that indicate future problems? How much change has there been compared with what was expected? Was the spending on track? What problems came up? Looking at where the project is now. Is the project still viable and on target to deliver the benefits expected of it? Is the risk still acceptable? Looking ahead. You look at the stage ahead, and in particular the stage level plan. Is that plan workable and achievable? Are the controls adequate? Is the staff resource confirmed to be in place? If the look back, look at the present position, and look ahead are all okay, the project manager gets the green light and can go and get on with the next stage. You can plan at 3 different levels. Project plan, produced by the project manager, consulting others, and covering all the delivery stages to give a high-level view of the whole project. Stage plans, one for each of the delivery stages, produced by the project manager at the end of the previous stage, just before the new stage commences. Delivery plan, produced this time by a team leader and covering a single work assignment. Sometimes the stage plan has sufficient detail to exercise control over the work of a particular assignment, and the team leader doesn't need a delivery plan. Stage and delivery plans are both drawn up from the level above. You develop a stage plan from the relevant section of the project plan, and a team leader develops a delivery plan, if needed, for an assignment from the relevant section of the stage plan. Developing a stage plan from a project plan is easy in overall concept, but quite a lot of hard work when it comes to the practicality. The project plan shows at a high level what products are being produced in each of the delivery stages, between about 15 and 30 products. When you're approaching a stage gate, it's time to start thinking about the stage plan for the following stage and identify the high-level, project-level products for that stage. There may be two or three of them. It rather depends on the size of your project. You then break these two or three products down in detail, normally using a work breakdown structure, until you again have 15 to 30. For these, you draw a workflow diagram and then go on to show the greater detail of activities in your activity network and Gantt chart. Of the 15 to 30 stage-level products, a work assignment or work package to be given to a team leader may comprise two or three of them or just a single product. Then exactly the same planning sequence is used all over again, but this time at an even lower level of detail. In exactly the same way as the product and activity plans show more detail at stage and then work package levels, you now go into more detail in your resource planning, including for financial resource. When lower-level plans are produced, it is common to find some things that weren't seen on the higher-level ones and to come up with better information, such as on activity durations. Each higher-level plan should be updated as necessary from what is discovered when doing the lower-level planning. Just occasionally, you may want to go against the just-in-time approach to planning, in which you plan just before that plan is required. You draw up a stage plan towards the end of the previous stage. For example, in larger projects, you may ask suppliers to draw up delivery plans for their parts of the work in a forthcoming stage, and then build the stage plan from the delivery plans. As in all areas of project planning, be flexible and do what's best for the project. The important thing is always doing what's best to get the job done. Chapter 9. Managing the risk. It's sad to hear about good projects that have failed, but it happens. It's even sadder when you find out a bit more and see that a project was killed off by a problem that the project manager could easily have foreseen, controlled, or even prevented. Don't let your project be unnecessarily damaged or even destroyed by something that, with a bit of effort, and sometimes not that much effort, you can get a handle on. This is the realm of risk management. The good news is that the basics aren't that difficult. In fact, you do risk management nearly all the time, just to get through the day. All projects need risk management, even the very small ones. However, some projects are clearly higher risk than others and justify more effort. Often the larger, more complex and longer your project is, the more risk management you need, but that doesn't let small projects off the hook. Risk is the possibility that you may not achieve some or all of your objectives because something unexpected occurs or something planned doesn't occur. All projects have some degree of risk, but the risk is generally greater the longer your project lasts, the more unusual and groundbreaking the project is, the less experience you, your organization, or your team members have with the type of project. The more vulnerable the project is to things happening outside, such as in the wider business or due to change of government policy, change in the marketplace, activity of competitors, or dependency on other projects. The newer your project's technology is. The current professional view of risk in projects is that it's about uncertainty, and that individual risks can be either positive or negative. Negative risks, also referred to as downside risks or threats, potentially have a detrimental effect on one or more of the project objectives, such as causing you to miss a deadline. Positive risks, also referred to as upside risk or opportunities, potentially have a beneficial effect on project objectives, such as allowing you to complete a task with fewer staff than you originally planned. Risk in projects is mostly negative, things that can go wrong. The negative view is in line with dictionary definitions of risk, of which one is the adverse consequences of future events. Obviously, wherever you can, you want to try to stop things going wrong and so increase the chance of success. Risk management can get complicated in high-risk projects, but for most it isn't going to be difficult, and for many, it's straightforward. The important thing is that you must manage risks, unless you want to open the project to the possibility of costly damage and even failure, when you might have been able to take a simple action to control it. It's been said that the right question isn't, should we do risk management, but rather, how much risk management should we do? On low-risk projects, you may not do much risk management, but you should always do some. For some projects, that may just mean gathering one or two people together for 20 minutes around a flip chart to look at what could go wrong with the project and how that might be controlled. Don't think that small projects don't need risk management. In some respects, small projects are inherently high risk. Take staffing, for example. If someone leaves your project and you have 200 people, the impact is about 0.5%. It may be more or less, depending on how important that person's job is. If there's just you and one other person and the other person leaves, the impact is magnified. It's 50%. It's important to take on board the exact wording of the subject area of this chapter, which is risk management. Managing risk doesn't necessarily mean avoiding it. Clearly, a positive risk, an upside risk, is something that you want to happen, and your management action includes making it more likely. However, even negative risk may be a good option in the project if the gain, such as time saving, is worthwhile. You should manage and communicate project risks from the beginning, and regularly. In particular, share information at the following points in your project. Starting the project, to support the process of deciding whether to undertake the project. Organizing and preparing, to guide the development of all aspects of your project plan. Carrying out the work, to regularly review risks and deal with any new ones found. Within the project, you can discuss this information at regular scheduled meetings, such as with the steering committee or project board. Working through the risk cycle. A cycle gives a framework to show how you analyze, decide actions, and then manage the risks that may affect a project. Different approaches to risk management offer different cycles. The steps after the initial identification of a risk go on continually, with regular review, right through the project. Clearly, if something about the risk has changed, such as it has become more severe, you may need to make changes in the way that you're handling that risk. It could be that a course of action that wasn't justified when the risk was low severity is now fully justified because the risk has become high severity. Here's an outline of the steps in the cycle. 1. Identify risks. Determine what the risks are that may affect your project. You want to look at things within the project, but also things that can come in from outside. During the project in particular, some new risks may also be reported to you by people involved in the project. 2. Analyze risks. This is where you get to grips with each risk to make sure you really understand it. You normally put some measures on each risk, such as the probability of the risk happening, and the impact if it does. 3. Decide risk handling. Here you think how you can protect your project from negative risk while trying to take advantage of positive risks. For some risks, you may decide not to take any action, but that's still a decision. 4. Add to or modify plans as necessary. Having decided what to do, if action is needed, you're going to have to build that into the plan. For example, there may be risk actions that you'll need to include in the activity plans. Because this step is part of the cycle, you may already have some management actions planned for a particular risk, so in this step you adjust the action to reflect any changes you've decided on. 5. Take planned action and monitor risk. There's no point in planning actions if you don't take them, so this step is to take action, either as an ongoing action or as a response if the risk happens. You also monitor each risk to see whether it's changing and to check that any action is effective. If the action is proving insufficient or the risk has changed, the cycle goes back to step 2 to reanalyze the risk and then on around the cycle again to decide how the risk handling should be changed. The first step is to identify the risks. You should record these in a risk register, which is simply a set of forms, each one describing a risk. Don't think of the risk register as bureaucratic, because you've got to be able to refer back to the information, and you can't do that if you don't record it. Identification isn't a repeatable part of the cycle, but remember that you will need to check for new risks periodically. This may be at the end of each stage or at regular intervals. The good thing about risk management is that there are lots of techniques out there to help. You can just think of risks